Good afternoon, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Kathleen will be back on Monday. There are 11 prisons within the federal prison system called Criminal Alien Requirement Facilities. They are unique in a couple of different ways. First, their day-to-day life is managed by private companies. Second, the prisoners inside all have one thing in common. They lack U.S. citizenship. Conditions within these prisons has been somewhat of a mystery. But that mystery is unfolding, and we'll talk about it this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show. People are dying in these prisons, and we're just now finding out why. My guest this afternoon is Seth Fried Wessler, an investigative journalist and the author of a story that will be the nation's cover story on February 15th, and also the subject of a broadcast to be carried on Wisconsin Public Radio next Monday night, NPR's podcast series Reveal. Seth Fried Wessler, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Great to be here.
So, at what point did you become aware of this story as a story? How did you get onto this? And talk about what you had to go through in order to cover it.
Well, I've been hearing for years about reports of neglect and abuse in the federal government's contracted prisons. Federal prisons that are operated by for-profit companies. But prisons are pretty difficult places to report on, to get access to. And so several years ago, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, an open records request, which I finally started getting documents from about a year ago after I filed a lawsuit to try to force the government to release the records. And what I obtained were the medical files of 103 men who've died inside of the Federal Bureau of Prisons contract prison system. The prison system is a sort of a weird thing in and of itself. The federal government operates a group of 11 prisons, separate federal prisons used only to hold non-citizens who've been convicted of federal crimes. And these prisons, unlike nearly all of the rest of the federal prison system, have been contracted out to private companies, companies like the GEO Group, Corrections Corporation of America, Management and Training Corporation. And the day-to-day operation of those facilities is run by those companies and a group of medical contractors, unlike the rest of the Bureau of Prisons system, which is actually run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons itself. These prisons, I learned, operate under a separate system of rules, often a much less stringent system. And the abuses that I found in these medical files, the records of people who've died, were striking and disturbing. And I write about that in this issue of The Nation.
Okay, so how many total prisons does the Federal Prison Bureau operate? You know?
The federal government holds about 200,000 prisoners. And as of last count, 23,000 prisoners were held in these immigrant-only private facilities. So it's a little less than 1 in 8 of the federal prison population.
And 108 deaths reported in these private prisons. Do we know how that compares to people who die in the rest of the federal prison system?
It's 103 deaths that I have files of. There have been at least 137 deaths in contract facilities generally. Comparisons are hard to make, and that's in part because prisons are hold different populations with different medical needs. What is clear from these files is that men are dying as a result of significant neglect, and the medical care that they're receiving isn't functioning under the same kinds of rules that regular BOP prisons operate under. The Bureau of Prisons enforces dozens of program statements in its own prisons, and that guides how people are held and how medical care operates. Many of those program statements, those rules, don't apply to these facilities. And the thinking is that the fewer rules applied, the less expensive it is to run the facilities. The kind of logic of opening contract facilities, when the first of them was open in the late 90s, was that that contracting out the operation of prisons to private companies would save the government money. And one of the clearest ways to do that is to operate medical care and staff prisons in less expensive ways. And that's one of the things that my investigation points to.
Okay, and I want to get to the details of that. I want to try and maybe work our way through how we got to this point, because it seems to me that prior to the late 1990s, if someone was apprehended in this country who was here illegally, they were simply deported. And unless they had committed a crime, they weren't put in prison. And if they did commit a crime, they were they not just held in the regular federal prison system?
That's right. So until the late 90s, people crossing the border without papers were often detained in immigration detention centers and then deported. And that still sometimes happens. But in the late 90s and into the 2000s, the federal government dramatically changed the kinds of consequences it applied to border crossing. In 2005, the Bush administration launched a program called Operation Streamline that began prosecuting people criminally for crossing over the border and imposed very long criminal sentences on people who crossed multiple times. And so rather than deport people and impose what has always been a civil consequence for a civil violation, that is, violating civil immigration laws, we began to prosecute these crimes, this act of crossing the border, as a crime. Now, in 2013, at the peak of these prosecutions, 91,000 people were prosecuted for border crossing crimes, more people than were prosecuted for drugs in federal courts. The prosecutions are now filling up our federal prison system, and one of the effects of that has been to fill up and justify the existence of this separate system of federal prisons used only for non-citizens. The federal government says that because these people will later be transferred to immigration authorities and deported after they serve that time in federal prison, that the federal government isn't obligated to provide the same level of reentry or rehabilitative kinds of services that it might provide to citizens who will return to their communities. And so as a result, the federal government has argued that non-citizens are kind of an ideal group for these less expensive, somewhat stripped down facilities.
Don't we have an obligation to provide at least a minimum of care and safety for these individuals? I mean, they are, even if they have broken the law, they're still human beings.
Well, certainly the rules are such that people held in these facilities are to be provided basic medical care. But what I found in my investigation is that in cases when certain rules are applied in the contracts that the company signed with the federal government, when the federal government is in fact required to follow certain rules, that the companies are often not following those rules. So I write about a man named Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, who was locked up in a prison in Reeves County, Texas, one of these 11 facilities, federal prisons in Reeves County, Texas. He was locked up, and he had tested positive for latent tuberculosis, which is not terribly uncommon. And BOP rules have it that if somebody tests positive for TB, that they should also be offered an HIV test. Well, Mr. Fajardo Saucedo wasn't offered that test. And despite the fact that the Bureau of Prisons monitors continued to show up at the prison and found over and over again that the facility was not in compliance with that rule, the prison never tested him for HIV. In fact, though he complained 18 times of increasing pain, headaches, back pain, mouth pain, he never saw a doctor, not one time in a 2-year period. Not until he was so ill and so weak that he fell down. He couldn't stand. And finally, he was sent to a local hospital where he tested positive for HIV, which killed him. Age-related brain infection killed him just days later in the local hospital. The Bureau of Prisons reviewed that case after he died in 2011 and found that had he been tested and had he been provided more appropriate and adequate care, that the disease very likely would have been flagged, and that he very likely medical care could have intervened earlier.
Are there any? I mean, you tell a lot of these stories, and I want to get to more of them because they're they're very powerful stories. But as you investigated and these various deaths that you investigated and the stories that you tell, were there ever any consequences for the violations of protocols or failures to follow the rules?
Well, I interviewed a number of people who work in these facilities and worked providing medical care, actually, in some of the cases that I wrote about, physician's assistants and licensed vocational nurses who provide a significant amount of the care in these facilities. They're very low-trained workers who are operating in significant part really running much of the medical care in these facilities. There are people who only see these low-trained medical workers. And in one case, a physician's assistant told me that despite clear failings, despite the fact that even the prison itself in its own post-death review found that the medical care had not been implemented correctly, he said that there were no significant consequences for any at all. What's striking is that the Bureau of Prisons continued in number of cases to find deficiencies over and over again, and the prisons continued to operate with the same deficiencies. Prisoners continued to suffer over and over again. The prisons remain open. In fact, in the case I just described of Fajardo Saucedo, as recently as 2015, Federal Bureau of Prisons monitors found that once again, prisoners who had tested positive for tuberculosis were not being adequately treated, appropriately treated, as policy would have says that they should be. So there's repeated failings, and the prisons remain in operation under the same management.
We're talking about what's going on in a private prison system for immigrants only, non-U.S. citizens, and what's going on in these private prisons with health care. People are dying. We're talking about an investigative report that it's the cover story in The Nation, and it's also going to be on the Reveal podcast from NPR, which WPR will be broadcasting on Monday evening at 7 o'clock on the Ideas Network. Wondering what you think of all of this. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program, 800-642-1234. You can send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, or find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. What obligations do you think we have to these prisoners? They're in jail because they repeatedly tried to cross the border into the United States illegally, not only tried, but in a lot of cases succeeded repeatedly and were picked up repeatedly and sent back repeatedly. Now they're in jail. Should that matter in terms of how they get treated once they are in our custody? What do you think? What needs to be changed? What needs to be done? What questions do you have? Seth Fried Wessler, who is the journalist who investigated this story, he's been working on it for years, and now we're reading what he has put together, and we're hearing about it from him this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Show. What questions do you have for Seth? 800-642-1234. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have some phone calls and some more questions. We'll hear some more stories, and we'll try and get some clarity on this issue between now and the end of the hour. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about a situation going on in our federal prison system. There are 11 prisons within the system operated by private contractors, where those incarcerated have one thing in common, that is none of them are U.S. citizens, and they're there because they tried to enter the country illegally and for various other reasons, but none of them are citizens. But what kind of care should they be receiving? There isn't any interest on the part of the federal government in rehabilitating these individuals. When they serve their time, they'll be deported back to their country of origin. But what about how we take care of them otherwise, their health, diet, and so forth? This is the subject of an investigative report by Seth Fried Wessler, senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism and a contributor to The Nation magazine. His investigation, reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund, with support from the Puffin Foundation, is the cover story of the February 15th edition of The Nation. It will also be part of the February 6th episode of Reveal, a new podcast and public radio show produced by the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, which airs on our Ideas Network Monday evening at 7 o'clock. Seth Fried Wessler is with me today on the Kathleen Dunn Show, and so are a lot of people on the phone. Let's start taking some phone calls. We'll start in Ladysmith. Brett is with us this afternoon. Brett, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am a correctional officer. I work at a state prison, and, you know, I'm very pleased and horrified at the same time. I'm pleased because I'm glad this issue is coming to light, because it has been an issue that, you know, I have seen. And, you know, I'm also horrified because my number one priority at the state-level prison is the safety and security of the individuals incarcerated, because, you know, their punishment is their incarceration, and we're just there to make sure they stay safe and secure. So I was just, like, really almost horrified, you know, that private prisons would allow this kind of actions to go on, and it's just crazy to hear for me, because my point of view is completely different at a state level.
Brett, thanks for sharing your insights with us. Seth?
Yeah, thanks for that call. I reported from across the country to look into what's happening in these prisons, and I spoke with correctional officers, and I spoke with people who work in the medical departments of these prisons. In West Texas, there's a town called Big Spring, and there's a number of prisons in that town. There's one federal prison in Big Spring that is a regular Bureau of Prisons correctional institution run by the Bureau of Prisons. The employees are government employees. And less than a mile away, there's a sprawling for-profit facility that's operated by the GEO Group. I talked to people who worked in both facilities. And one of the things I learned is that in the Bureau of Prisons-run facilities, which holds Bureau of Prison prisoners, the medical department's largely staffed by registered nurses, highly trained registered nurses who are skilled to do lots of things in medical care, can manage significant situations, are trained to respond to emergencies. In the other prison, which also holds federal prisoners but is operated by a private company, many of those same jobs are being filled with licensed vocational nurses who have a year of training, are generally trained to be supportive staff only. And both the doctors who reviewed the medical files I obtained, as well as a physician's assistant who works in that facility, raised serious concerns about whether those licensed vocational nurses have the skills and knowledge to provide the kind of care that they're being asked to provide. And so it's a situation where in the medical departments, there are medical workers who are being placed in positions that they may well not be equipped to handle. On the correctional side, the correctional officers at the private facilities, I spoke with officers who work there as well as in the BOP-run facility. They say that the correctional officers tend to be less experienced, are often much, much younger, and are coming in without much or in some cases any previous correctional experience. And that raises all sorts of questions for the people who work there about the level of the capacity of those people to do what is, in fact, a very difficult job. So, you know, the workers in these facilities are put in positions that that make it very difficult for care to function as it should. In one of the cases that I write about, and the case that will be part of that episode of Reveal this weekend, a man had a stroke late at night and when his cellmates called for help, the medical worker on call was a licensed vocational nurse who, according to the physician's assistant who I spoke with, who got a phone call from that licensed vocational nurse, simply didn't have the ability, the capacity to really figure out what was going on. That man was left in his cell for the night, and by the time the morning nurses came back to him, it was too late. His face was drooping, and when he finally got to the hospital, 7 hours after his cellmates called for help, the neurologist who cared for him, who I spoke with, said it was too late, that the time to respond to him would have been right away when the fellow prisoners first made the call for help, first tried to get the attention of a guard. The worker I spoke with, the medical worker I spoke with there, told me that simply the LVN just didn't have the knowledge or skills to analyze the medical situation in front of him.
And again, you know, these prisons are audited. There are reports that are filed. They're found to be deficient. Who's ultimately responsible for looking at these audits and making a determination? I mean, we're talking about we spend over $600 million to contract with these private companies every year to provide services. And when they don't live up to the contract that they signed, who's supposed to be looking at this, and why is this allowed to continue?
Well, so the Federal Bureau of Prisons monitors these facilities, and they find failings in these facilities. In fact, the DOJ's, the Department of Justice Office of Inspector General, investigated the Reeves facility and found that the facility was consistently understaffed. Also found that the federal government may have been incentivizing that understaffing by docking the fees it paid to the companies at a rate that was less than they actually would have paid those workers had they brought them on. But there've been a litany of findings that the prisons are operating outside of standards of practice, outside of the rules. But the prisons continue to operate. Sometimes they've been fined. In the case of Reeves, where that OIG report was conducted, the prison was fined, and contract fees it paid were docked. But the practices appear not to have changed, at least for several years. And as I said previously, as recently as last year, the same failings that were flagged in 2009. The same failings that contributed to the death of Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, who should have been tested for HIV and was not, were continuing to operate. So even as they're fined, the prisons maintain the contracts. The companies that are operating continue to run the facilities.
You have a lot of stories within your story. Martin Acosta, tell us his story.
Yeah, Martino Costa was incarcerated in that same facility in Reeves, and he began complaining of stomach pain. And for several months, he complained of intensifying stomach pain, but was normally seen only by members of the nursing staff, usually these licensed vocational nurses, and on most of those occasions was simply sent back to his room with Maalox. He told the nursing staff that the Maalox didn't work, and maybe that time they wouldn't send him back with Maalox, but then he would return a couple of weeks later, and once again he would be handed Maalox to take to deal with this stomach issue that was getting worse and worse, and that he was complaining of and saying was producing significant pain. At one point, he was asked to give a stool sample, but the records I obtained through my open records request, the medical files from this prison, suggest that the nurse who collected that sample simply eyeballed the sample and never ran a lab, never ran tests to find out what was actually happening, and deemed it unproblematic. Well, he became sicker and sicker until it was impossible to think that simply he needed Maalox. And he was sent to a local hospital, and a massive tumor was found in his stomach. He died not long after that in the hospital of stomach cancer. And, you know, it's a story that's repeated over and over again in these files. People not being seen by doctors, seen only by low-level nursing staff or very often by those nursing staff members. And, you know, I spoke with a former Federal Bureau of Prisons doctor who was also a clinical director in the Bureau of Prisons and in immigration detention centers. He's retired, and he read that file, and we talked about what it represented. And what he said is the fear of a doctor in a prison like this is that the frontline staff, if they're not well enough trained to catch basic issues, that the doctors are never going to hear about serious issues. And he thinks that that's what happened in this situation. This man was being cared for by low-level workers who didn't understand what they were seeing and were never reporting it back up to the doctor, a doctor who never, for several months in that case, didn't see this person until his condition had devolved significantly.
Mm. We have some more callers who want to join us, and there are lines available for you if you'd like to join the discussion, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We're talking about the conditions in these private federal facilities, which are housing non-U.S. citizens. And what it's like there, and the deaths that occur there from the lack of proper medical care. We'll go to Wisconsin Dells next. Logan is with us. Logan, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yes, go ahead.
So I'm in Wisconsin Dells, and a large portion of our workforce, our neighbors here, they're undocumented. These are folks who may have crossed the border illegally or, in a lot of cases, overstayed their visas. So I have two questions here. One, if one of our friends or coworkers gets picked up and they're going through the system, there's very little education of what rights they have. What can we do to help them understand their rights? Is there paperwork they shouldn't sign, things like that? And then if they are detained in one of these private prisons, what can we do to make sure that our friends, our coworkers, our employees even, are being treated to the highest standards?
Seth, I don't know if you can answer the first part of his question, but what can people do if they know somebody who's in one of these 11 detention centers to make sure they're getting being taken care of properly?
Well, I want to just say, in answer to the question, I think that the prosecutions that land many people in these prisons aren't well understood. So the federal government operates immigration detention centers. Many of those immigration detention centers, which are under the Department of Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs Enforcement runs them. Many of those are similarly operated by for-profit companies. Some of them are operated by Immigration and Customs Enforcement itself. Others are operated by counties, and the federal government contracts with them. Those are places where people are held if they're picked up for civil violations of immigration law, and they're held there pending deportation or a decision about whether they'll be deported. These prisons that I'm writing about are different. These are criminal prisons used to hold non-citizens. Nearly half of the people in these prisons are held for a crime that used to not be a crime, that is, for crossing the border. So somebody could be sent to an immigration detention center for crossing the border, and another person might be prosecuted criminally for doing the same thing and sent to one of these Bureau of Prisons facilities. The numbers of prosecutions, as we discussed, for illegal reentry, criminal prosecutions, have skyrocketed in recent years. Most of those prosecutions are originating from Border Patrol near the border, near the southern border with Mexico, and Border Patrol is referring people who've crossed to federal prosecutors for prosecution in federal court. But sometimes these prosecutions also originate from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which often operate in local jails, often have a connection to local jails and are often flagging people who are picked up by local authorities. So immigration officials, ICE officials, may be sending people who are undocumented to federal prosecutors, to the AUSAs, for prosecution for illegal reentry. These prisons can be very difficult places to maneuver. I looked at a file of a man who was held in one of these federal contract facilities. He had made a number of complaints about medical care that he was receiving, And he was finally actually able to get his grievance heard by, read by the Federal Bureau of Prisons contracting office. The Bureau of Prisons itself took a look at his grievances. But the Bureau of Prisons contracting officials responded to him by saying that the contract company, the private company that's contracted to run the prison, that they had already issued a decision about what kind of medical care he should receive, whether or not he should receive the particular procedure that he believed he needed. And because the private company had already rendered that decision, that the federal government would respect the decision made by the private company. So this is a situation where somebody who's a prisoner held by the Bureau of Prisons is able finally, after a significant amount of time, to get the Bureau of Prisons to hear his complaint, and the Bureau of Prisons turns around and says, well, the private company has already made a determination about the kind of medical care you should receive, so we will respect that. It can be a very, very difficult system for people to negotiate. And I think it's one of the problems. Even the doctors who I interviewed, even a doctor in that Big Spring facility who I interviewed, who retired several years ago but was the medical director of that facility, he said that he felt that he was kind of covered under layers of bureaucracy, not just the BOP, but also the corrections company, Geo Group, and a medical subcontractor that he worked directly for. So unlike a Bureau of Prisons doctor in a Bureau of Prisons prison, who can call up the central office and say, look, we need to move this guy out of here. He's too sick to be here. The doctor who is working for a contract company, he couldn't do that. He couldn't call the Bureau of Prisons. He had to call his boss in the subcontractor, who might have to call the contractor, who might call the BOP. People can get lost in these facilities.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Seth Fried-Wessler on the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about the conditions in private prisons for non-U.S. citizens operated under contract from private contractors through the Bureau of Prisons, the federal agency assigned to take care of federal prisoners. And what's going on there? We've reports of 103 deaths at these prisons, and reports suggest that a lot of these deaths are happening because health care is simply not adequate in these for-profit facilities. Wondering what you think. We have full phone lines right now, but I'm sure a line will be opening up soon if you'd care to join our conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also carry on a conversation through the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Leave your comment or question there. This hour, we're talking about a story that will be on the cover of the February 15th of The Nation magazine. Seth Fried-Wessler is the investigative reporter who covered this story. He's senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism. This story will also be part of the February 6th episode of Reveal, a new podcast and public radio show produced by the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, which will air on the Ideas Network Monday evening at 7 o'clock. So, Seth, were you able to speak with anybody in the corporate management structure of these private prison facilities? Did they have any comment on what's happening there as far as medical care? Were you able to talk to anybody who was a higher up, a decision maker in the, for example, with the subcontractor for medical services?
Corrections Corporation of America and the Management and Training Corporation, which run some of these prisons, didn't respond to my questions. Geo Group responded with a general statement saying that they follow the rules that they're required to follow, which include the rules that the BOP prisons are required to follow, but didn't respond specifically to my questions about their practice, their more specific practices, nor about any particular deaths that I uncovered. You know, I asked them about these deaths, and as we said earlier, 103 people died in these facilities, or rather, I've obtained the records of 103 men who died in these facilities. Women who are non-citizens are sent into regular federal prisons. But of those 103 files, I asked doctors, medical doctors, to review all of them. I put a panel together of medical doctors. And In a third of the cases that they were able to review, in a third of the cases that had enough information in the files where doctors felt that they could render a judgment on the adequacy of the care, doctors who read the files agreed that the care was not only inadequate, but that it likely contributed to these deaths. So they were seeing, and we saw in the files as I read them, men who were sick with cancer and AIDS, men with significant mental illness, men who had had strokes, who simply were not provided the kind of care that they needed and who very likely would have survived had they been provided adequate medical care, had they been able to access medical care that exists in the free world. The stories are over and over again, 25 cases where doctors agreed that the medical care had been inadequate and likely contributed to these men's premature death.
We have an email question from Haley. Haley wants to know, are these inmates doing prison labor for these private companies? They're not getting rehabilitated. Are they working? Are they producing things for the companies? Do we have chain gangs?
I'm not sure whether there's industry happening inside of these prisons, but these prisoners are doing a significant amount of labor inside the prisons. They work in the kitchen, they cut grass, they do maintenance work. Much of their time is spent doing work that's necessary to run the prison. So I don't know, in fact, whether there's a separate industry or prison industries functioning here. I think not. I think that these prisons don't include that kind of labor, but rather these prisoners are doing the sort of day-to-day work that keeps the prison running. And you know, many of them talked about working in the kitchen or doing yard work, mowing the grass, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234. Let's take a call from Juan, who's calling us from Illinois. Juan, go ahead.
Yes. Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Basically, just from what I'm hearing this, it sounds to me that these prison systems were basically created to create cash flow, you know? You say that President Bush created this law. I wonder what politician has stocks into this if these prisons are run with minimal personnel and you have the prisoners doing a lot of the work. So this, to me, looks like, something that's gone wrong. I would assume that the taxpayers should be really upset about this, considering a lot of these individuals were probably already in this country. Being employees, paying taxes, even though they were illegal. And I'm speaking firsthand because I was brought to this country when I was about 5 to 6 years old. Myself, I started a business when I was about to turn 20. The majority of the individuals that have worked for me are Caucasian. My kids are half Mexican, half white. It's pretty... It's pretty stressful, you know, and it's disappointing to see these things happen in a country that was built by immigrants. You have the Native Americans and Mexicans that are basically your local people from this America. You know, before there was a line called border, this and was our land, you know, and we welcome anybody, you know, from other countries here. And it's like, now you have these immigrants kicking the natives out. And, obviously this involves a lot of people from a lot of countries. But as far as I'm concerned, what I see from politicians now is creating problems or finding a problem to create a bogus solution that creates cash flow to them, such as the war and all these other things that now it's become too big and it's not really there to help the citizens, but to oppress the citizens.
One, thank you for sharing your insights with us. Seth, what's the political dimension here? I mean, it seems to me that there was Congress passed some sort of a law that required, actually, they wanted it stipulated something like 34,000 plus prisoners need to be housed every year or something like that. They almost set a quota on it. What's the political side
actually,
of this?
That's actually a different issue. What you're referring to is the bed quota for immigration detention, which this is not. The history of these prisons goes back to the late 90s. The Clinton administration had promised in the sort of era of reinventing government not to grow the size of the federal workforce. But the late 90s was also a period of massive expansion of the criminal justice system. People were being locked up in the drug war in massive numbers. And these two imperatives, not expanding the size of government while also expanding the federal prison system, they didn't really mesh very well together. But the solution that the Clinton administration came up with was to privatize federal prisons so that you could both expand the prison population without expanding the federal employee population. And so in the late 90s, the first of these prisons opened. And then as the numbers of non-citizens who were being prosecuted began to grow, these prisons became the place where that population of prisoners went, for the reasons I talked about before, that these prisoners will be deported later, and there was a belief that they're therefore not their government's not obligated to provide the same services. You know, in 2005, years after the first of these opened, the federal government, the Bureau of Prisons, the Department of Justice, conducted several studies or contracted for the several studies to be done about to look into whether actually these prisons did save money, which was part of what the White House's budget request suggested that these were for in the first place. And what the studies found, what the Department of Justice studies found, is that on the one hand, yeah, this first prison was able to operate on the cheap, and it had done that largely by cutting employee benefits, by cutting compensation for employees. But a second study found that even those savings were eclipsed by the cost of oversight that the government had to continue to provide to oversee these prisons. And so it's not even clear that the prisons that were intended to save money, in fact, did save the government any money. And prison officials, including one prison official who was part of that implementing that initial evaluation, said that, you know, what became clear was that as these prisons tried to save on costs, quality really suffered.
Mm. We have a lot more phone calls to get to, so let's go back to the phones. And Louise from Milwaukee, you'll be next. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. This is interesting. Because the number one reason for a private prison, I mean, I don't care what anybody will tell you, the number one interest for a private company is profit. If it doesn't profit, they're going to shut it down. Now, we understand that a lot of these businesses, their number one overhead is health care. You know, that's their number one expense. So why not try to cut one of the biggest expense with a population of people that basically nobody cares about? It's sad to say, but who's really complaining about this besides maybe this radio station, which is great, by the way. I listen to it every day. I forgot my second point. Oh, yeah. This has been going on for years now at the state level. I'm here in Wisconsin right now, and I have firsthand experience in this topic. I did go to the prison system myself. I personally seen three people die because of lack of health care. And I'm quite sure that the health care here in Wisconsin for the prison system is run by private companies some way, shape, or form, because we had to get some sort of permission from them before we can get any type of medication. And for any type of ailment we had, anything from a sore down to people with cancer, the first thing you get was ibuprofen. So thank y'all. Continue listening off the air.
Okay. Thanks, Luis. Appreciate your insight. What about these prisons are operated for profit, and health care is the most expensive piece other than personnel? Easy to cut that.
Absolutely. I mean, healthcare and staffing are the two places that prisons spend the most money and where they can cut. And in the case of these prisons, what I found is that the staffing of medical care, the use of low-trained, licensed vocational nurses instead of much more highly skilled registered nurses is one way where these prisons appear to be cutting significant costs. They just cost less money. One of the things that's particular about these prisons, you know, the Bureau of Prisons is generally considered to be, as far as prisons go, a better run prison system. They have a set of rules. They're fairly centrally regulated. The employees are government employees who follow a set of rigorous standards. And, you know, in general, when prison advocates talk about prisons, they talk about the BOP as a sort of a better prison. But these contract facilities, you know, doctors who reviewed the files who have experience looking at and working in prison medical care described what they saw in the files I obtained, in the medical files I obtained. They said it looked more like a county jail that's, you know, which are known to often function with serious deficiencies and major problems in medical care, that these prisons didn't look like we'd imagine a federal prison should look, but rather a county jail that's much less accountable.
Let's take another call. Marcus is with us from Green Bay. Marcus, go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to talk about advocacy, you know, as far as the medical thing goes. You know, I had my knees replaced a little over a year ago. I have insurance, and if my daughters would have been there to help me before, during, and after, to, you know, you need to ask this question, and they were there for some meetings, and my neighbor had a stroke with terminal brain cancer, if I wouldn't have been there for all the meetings. So I want to say that, you know, like, use it as abusing it. Try to imagine these people with nobody there to advocate for them, to get the doctors, the nurses, and everything, to keep them going, keep the ball rolling. And in as far as I'm concerned, using is abusing. And I think we're using human lives for profit, and these people there know that there's no one else to stand for them, and they can just let them mm-hmm. sit in their cell and give them Maalox. Okay. And, you know, if you could touch on that, the human...
Okay.
The human.
All right. Marcus, we've got to let you go because we're almost out of time. Seth, what about this? I mean, our previous caller said, hey, nobody cares about these people, so, you know, there's nobody to make a fuss. Who advocates for these prisoners?
Well, let me just say that there are people who care about these men. Those people are the family members, many of whom I talked to. Family members, mothers, children, wives and partners of these men who are in Mexico or in the U.S., and in some cases had no idea what was happening to their loved one. In some cases, didn't even know why their loved ones were locked up. You know, from across a border, prisons are already difficult places to access. If you have a border in the way and a language barrier, many of these families didn't know what was happening. So many of these men are doubly disappeared into this system. It's not just prison. It's also a border between them and a tremendous lack of access for families. You know, when I would call families in Mexico and in some cases go visit those people to talk about the men that they lost, the family members that they lost, I had, because of these files, a tremendous amount more information than they did. There were people who didn't know why their loved ones died, didn't know why their loved ones were incarcerated, and it was incredibly striking. But you know, it's also important to remember that these men were members of families and continue to be before they were locked up.
Sure. I guess my point was, though, that yes, there are people that care about them, but they're not in any position to be able to do anything about it. Who is advocating? Is there some sort of effective advocacy that's available for these prisoners in the United States?
Advocates more broadly are beginning to call for, I hear advocates calling for, a ramping down of these contract facilities, pulling them out of the federal criminal justice system. You know, the federal prison system is beginning to shrink. Sentencing reform is a hot debate right now. And for the first time, the number of prisoners is falling. There are real questions about whether, as that happens, should contract facilities be the first to go.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it there. Seth Fried-Wessler, thanks for your report and for sharing your information with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me on. It's great to be here.
Seth Fried-Wessler, whose story will be on the cover of the February 15th edition of The Nation and also covered in the reveal podcast, which will be carried on the Ideas Network on Monday night at 7 o'clock. KP Whaley produced this hour of programming and handled on-air production. Dave Potratz did his usual outstanding job of technical direction. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Stick around another hour to go on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned.